Today is Thursday, April 29th, 2004, and I, Sara Shostak, am interviewing Dr. Kenneth Olden of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And you realize that I'm recording our conversation?
Yes, fine.
Wonderful. Could you begin with telling me about how the NTP had evolved during its first 10 or so years?
I marked off the first three questions. I'm not the best person to answer the first three.
Okay.
But there are people around who could do that for you.
All right. Who are there particular people you'd suggest?
Well, yes, I would suggest a fellow by the name of George Lucier.
I've interviewed.
And he used to work with us, obviously.
Great.
He's very good, and he was there from, if not the beginning, I think the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a good perspective on my era plus the earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So he could do that.
Okay, so let's pick up then with what sorts of challenges you perceived when you assumed the leadership of the NTP?
I thought that the NTP had done a very good job in making a case to the American people in Congress that toxicity testing was important to the public health mission of this nation. And I think they had done a good job in establishing a role for themselves, for the agency, in the health research enterprise of this nation, in the public health aspect of this nation. However, I think the program, there was not a lot of innovation in the program.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think, I'm not sure that you can ask people like Hugo Bingham or some of those people about it who had a role in the development of the NTP, but at least as I look back, I want to thank Congress and its wisdom. Mm-hmm. Felt that the National Toxicology Program should be in a science-based agency, and that the science from that agency should influence the conduct of toxicity testing. I think that was not occurring when I got there. I think NTP was viewed itself as a laboratory testing enterprise rather than a science agency, and there's a difference. And they were doing tests that were kind of conventional, standard, and I think without intervention and heavy-handed intervention, they would still be doing that. And the NIEHS always, at least from the time I arrived, had very good intramural science. Mm-hmm. And since NTP is also an intramural program, you would think that there would be dialogue, interactions between the people who were leading and participating in the NTP side and people who were in the NIEHS intramural science track. But that was not occurring. I didn't think there was any or minimal synergy and interactions between the two programs. And NTP, for example, was contracting with scientific laboratories to do things scientifically, to look at oncogenes and to do tests, to do real biology, to do biology. And whereas we had scientists in the Institute who were far better, more knowledgeable, performing those tests and interpreting them than the contract lab. So why were we paying and buying inferior science when we had it inside? We were already paying these guys. And they wanted to do something more practical and more relevant and more immediately practical and more immediately relevant than what, you know, the conduct of basic science is just that. It's basic science. It need not have practical application today or tomorrow. It's way down the road when that is finally somebody realizes that this little piece of discovery made 20 years ago could be applied to develop a product, good or service, or a treatment strategy. But that's a long ways down the road. And basic scientists often don't think of a long term. They just like the excitement of doing the science today. So I think I still think there's benefit in getting basic scientists more in tune with the issues that we're facing today. So that way that they begin to think of the urgency of solving important public health problems. And I'm a basic scientist like that. I'm a basic scientist, but I don't want to just go in my laboratory and do fancy science and publish papers in great journals. I want to know that I'm really impacting people's lives. And I like to see it in a public health prevention intervention effort, as a public policy, in public policy, or in a clinical setting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want my science utilized. I feel better about it. And everybody, I think everybody essentially does. Mm-hmm. Just that, so I thought there was not the kind of interactions, and there were, or the opportunities didn't exist. There were firewalls. Mm-hmm. And the budget, also money is a big issue. The budget was distributed three ways in the intramural research program when I got there. It was biometry and risk assessment was one division. Then the testing program, NTP, was another division. And then there was the intramural research program. So let's say we had $100 million to distribute three ways, then the impact that we could have was far less. Mm-hmm. Especially if those three groups didn't interact and talk with each other. Mm-hmm. So I really felt that we should take all the money and put it in one place, $100 million, whatever it was, and say, look, I want the three groups to get together and talk to each other, and let's plan strategically. Mm-hmm. So if we make a discovery in NTP, I just had a meeting with Francis Collins, we're talking about mouse models. Mm-hmm. Well, I said to him, we 36 years of NTP, early on, what they were doing was make, we would add and describe. It was, the science was descriptive and phenotypic in nature. In other words, we'd add a chemical and we'd describe the results, and we'd describe the phenotype, what happened. But we didn't know anything about mechanism. We didn't know anything about the genetic background of the animals. And animals, from animal to animal, or even in mice, there are something like 50 different strains of mice, and it varies. Some strains would be a chemical A would be carcinogenic, and other strains it would not, and that didn't seem to bother anybody. Mm-hmm. But it is very important, because if you generate data in one strain of mice that says this is a problem, but not in another, you don't know which is most relevant for human risk assessment. So there is no effort to try to define the genetic background of these animals to see which was more relevant to humans. And that's what Francis Collins and I were talking about a few minutes ago. And now we have a contract on the street to get people are competing for the contract to take the 15 or 16 most commonly used mouse strains in toxicity testing, and see what the genetic variation is in these animals, and see if we can see any correlation between genetic background and phenotype. In other words, all the pathology that we've seen over the years.
That's fascinating.
It is. I mean, that's the power of bringing things together. Mm-hmm. And so, I the beauty of this is NTP people are at the table in this discussion, mm-hmm. and they have a lot to offer. You know, we have 36 years of experience, of descriptive data. So we know what the phenotype is. We just need to know what the genetic background is. Mm-hmm. And can we bring those two together to improve human risk assessment? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, yes, you can. Mm-hmm. But we don't, but you have to make the investment to think that genetics is important. Mm-hmm. And not just go down this pike forever and ever and ever, tested by some standard protocol. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I've done to the NTP. So when I got there, I felt that we weren't looking enough at mechanisms. It's fine to say that chemical or physical agent A causes some disease endpoint or some toxicity, but if you don't know how it causes that endpoint, mm-hmm. then you can never intervene. You can never prevent. Yes, of course you can. You can remove that agent from the environment. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what, that was the thinking when I got there. Mm-hmm. That if we identify an environmental chemical, for example, as being carcinogenic or teratogenic or whatever, then we will pass have EPA and pass regulation to remove that chemical from the environment. And so that does, you know, that will prevent the health, adverse health outcomes. But in some cases, some of these products, you think lead is, and mercury, some of these agents, you aren't going to, and even now, automobile exhaust, we can reduce it, but it's going to be a long time before we get many of these things out of our environment. And the question is, what happens to us, our next generation and generation after that, while we're doing that? So if you understood something about prevention, intervention after the exposure, then maybe we could prevent the progression of a disease like cancer that maybe develops over a period of 30 or 40 years. Or if you just slow down the process, take prostate cancer, if you could just slow down prostate cancer to half the rate it is now, no males would die from prostate cancer. I don't think anybody would, because, you know, people die in the 80s now, and you'd have to live 100 and something, and I don't know many people live 100 and something. So you would, so you don't have to even cure things, you just have to understand and slow it down or prevent it. And so I think that is a much better approach, because some of these products that we have in our environment are useful. And they all were, at least except the natural ones, was produced with that expectation. I mean, chemical industry and pharmaceutical industry and even a manufacturing industry, they didn't produce all these byproducts of manufacturing and so forth to poison us to death. They were producing useful technology, like the automobile. The automobile and the airplane, very useful. But there are some risks, there are some downsides. So can we have the airplane, for example, or the automobile, or, you know, nanotechnology without the downside? So let's identify what are the downsides, and let's try to figure out why is it? What are the problems? And let's fix them. So, because, otherwise, you know, we certainly set our society way back in terms of the economy, in terms of conveniences and quality of life. So let's just take one approach, and I think there was a myopic approach to how we prevent cancer, is that we identify, we tell the EPA and FDA and whomever, OSHA, and they regulate, and you just take that insulation out of your house.
So you undertook a significant reorganization.
Right.
Fairly soon after arrival. Can you tell me about that?
Well, yeah. When I first got there, I went around and met with, that's kind of, I have what I say is interactive, inclusive management style. And I like to go out and talk to the people, the stakeholders, whoever they are. And I, you know, whoever pays taxes, they're stakeholders to me. And so I went out and talked to the American people, lay people. I talked to industry leaders. I visited DuPont and Dow Chemicals. I went to EPA and FDA, and I talked to scientists and leaders and all members of Congress. And basically what I was doing is saying is, what should an agency like NIEHS, NTP be doing for you, since you provide us the resources? What are your concerns about your health and the environment? I heard, I listened. And then I learned that people were not uniformly pleased with the way we were doing business. And that unless we did change, we were pretty much not so. I think we were perceived as the overall. It's not been terribly mainstream and relevant. And we had to change. We had to incorporate modern science, take advantage of new innovations in cell and electrobiology, and develop new test systems. Matter of fact, it was in our mandate. So we were just sitting and using a few very standard assays that have been in existence for years, and there are still people who tell me we should still be doing that. But so I felt that we were not providing a very quality product, and that the efficiency was very poor. In other words, we were spending too much money, there was not the synergy between the programs that should be there. we were not looking at mechanisms, so you couldn't prevent except through behavioral modification. So I made a decision to have the review groups to come in and look at the programs as well, and they also supported my thinking. But I made a decision to take the three divisions and fold them into one. And I didn't tell anybody, didn't give any hint that I had that, was thinking like that. But I just walked in one day in a conference room like this, had all the senior leadership, and said, guys, as of today, we have one division in the intramural research program. Mm-hmm. And you are out as division chief, not because you're doing your job, but you happen to be over that division, and they no longer exist. Mm-hmm. And we have one division, so I can give the money to one person mm-hmm. and hold him accountable. And what had been happening while I had been there a few months, I was going around and giving talks about we're doing this and we're doing that and we're going this direction and that direction. And I would go back and talk to my senior leadership and charge them to doing it. But discover 6 months later, not a damn thing happened. Mm-hmm. And I would go back and say, well, guys, why didn't this happen? Well, Dr. So-and-so, he didn't like it. I couldn't get him to do whatever. And so I didn't know who to blame. Mm-hmm. So, and I, you know, so finally I said, okay, fine, I'll stop that. You get the money, and I'm talking to you, and if you don't do it, then I can do whatever I need to do to make sure that I get somebody here who can do it.
And was that person the scientific director?
Yes, I gave it to the scientific director. There was somebody already who had the title of scientific director, mm-hmm. and I didn't replace him. I just said, mm-hmm. you are the scientific director. Now you're the scientific director for the entire intramural research activity.
And was that Carl Barrett at the time?
No, that was John McLaughlin at the time. And John left a few years later, and I made Carl Barrett the scientific director. So that's how that happened. And it made all, and you can imagine, I mean, all hell broke loose.
I was going to ask.
And I would say I wasn't sure I was going to survive more than, I mean, they went after me. Mm-hmm. But Philby was the assistant secretary for health, and that was when we had a real assistant secretary. In other words, the assistant secretary was a cabinet level position, mm-hmm. and it was approved by Congress. Mm-hmm. And so he was, and he had been the first. So Phil was back, very seasoned, knew his way around, and he stuck by me mm-hmm. and just said, you know, what are you doing, Ken? I told him what I was doing, and I explained it just, you know, that things weren't going happening and we weren't doing fine. Mm-hmm. So I survived. Mm-hmm. But then there was an assessment later on in science. Science came in a magazine, mm-hmm. and there was an article called Ken Olin Hill's NIEHS's Split Brain. Mm-hmm. He brought these hemispheres together. And they went around and interviewed people randomly, I guess, people with leaders in the field. And I remember Bernie Goldstein, he's a very prominent leader, said, you know, I mean, I was skeptical, he said, you know, I didn't think it, but my gosh, Holden was right, it worked. And that was the sentiment, mm-hmm. that it had worked.
How long did it take for that sentiment to emerge?
I can't remember. It took 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I caught hell, mm-hmm. Because the dissenters would get together and write open letters to the editor and publish them in certain kind of little throwaway newsletters, and they would appear, or in Washington, some magazine. And so they gave me a hard time. But finally, that group disappeared. Mm-hmm. I mean, they basically became convergent. Mm-hmm. And now, some of them are my strongest supporters. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there were people who signed that letter. They wouldn't sign such a letter today, mm-hmm. and they don't. Mm-hmm. You know, our letter's been out there, and they can't get the signatures now. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always one or two persons out there who never please with what you do if it's mm-hmm. going forward. Mm-hmm. But now those people are believers. Mm-hmm. They recognize the program. And some of those people were on my council. They weren't sure either. But there's a lot of testimony on my council. Some people come back because they are recycling. And they'll say, look, I was here 10 years ago. I was here the day Olin took over. And I knew I was here when all this happened. My gosh, this place is totally different. Mm-hmm. It's much better. Matter of fact, one of the candidates for my position was there.
Mm-hmm.
And he just sings my praises now, mm-hmm. because he knows the Institute, knew the Institute before, and he knows it after mm-hmm. I changed it.
Mm-hmm.
And he is now excited about being a finalist mm-hmm. for the position.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I convince people mm-hmm. That you know, this is, we were doing the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And just yesterday, I had a dinner with friends and just waiting for this husband to come home. I was reading the Washington Post, and right there in one of the sections is a half page on our children's longitudinal study mm-hmm. that we're planning. Good press.
Mm-hmm.
NIHS, we wouldn't have been there in years mm-hmm. 91 and before, because we weren't doing things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We were very narrowly focused on toxicity testing. And the Institute was defined on the basis of cancer, first of all, and toxicity testing.
Mm-hmm.
Children's health wasn't on our radar screen.
Mm-hmm.
But I went in and talked to people and said, this is in our mandate. And we should be addressing all of these important public health issues as they relate to the environment. So we created the Children's Centers, we did this, we did that, and now we're collaborating with Child Health and CDC and EPA to develop this large cohort of children, because that's the way we're going to figure out how gene and environment interact, and we aren't going to do it any other way. So we finally decided to bite the bullet and to do it. So we've been sponsoring that effort, and I was so proud to see we would have been in there for toxicity testing,
mm-hmm.
but we are in there for a number of other good mm-hmm. things that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. You're getting press on that all the way into small
right.
town America,
right.
too, because my mom sent me
yes.
a clipping on it
right.
from Fort
right.
Collins.
Oh, good. That's good to hear. Good to hear. You see, and those kind of things play well mm-hmm. with congressional people
mm-hmm.
because, and parents, I mean, you know, parents and grandparents and that's what we're proposing to do now, kind of working on, is to expand the study to include parents and grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will be a very large family study.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we will be able to say, after X numbers of years, by gosh, we have all the interactions. We can identify the crucial interaction between genes and environment that lead to human disease and dysfunctions and disability.
Mm-hmm.
But that's visionary. You have to make the investment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that we're doing now that's really putting us on the map.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this morning, Francis Collins wanted us to have this meeting with him because he heard that we were going out and having 15 mouse strains, haplotype maps.
Mm-hmm.
But haplotype mapping of a mouse genome sounds like something human genome should be doing. No, we should be doing it. And I sat down, and you want to know why and all, and I sat down with two of my people, and we explained it. Fine, understood it, going the right way, he's on it, onto it, but we're going to have a huge impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, we're interested in this because we typically use anywhere from 15 to 16 different mouse strains to do toxicity testing. And if you put a chemical in strain A, it may be carcinogenic. If you put it in strain C or D, it may not be. And we don't know, you know, so we regulate based on it's
right.
But we don't know that the strain A is relevant to human risk assessment, or it's B and C where it wasn't carcinogenic.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is standard, as I said to Francis, except the background. We can, it's a controlled experiment. The only thing that we don't control is the genetics of this inbred strain.
Right.
So there must be genetic variations among the strains,
mm-hmm.
and if we knew what those genetic variations are or were, then we would know, could identify the causes of the variation. I mean, why does it give cancer in this one and not in that one? And we could do something, so a lot we could do with that information. So that's why we want this information.
Mm-hmm.
So he could see that, right, this fits with their mission,
right.
See? And so we made this argument. The meeting really went well. Now he wants to be a player with this,
mm-hmm.
and he had a little project looking at a couple of things that relate to it, but his is a million and a half and ours is a 12 million project.
Mm-hmm.
So we will come in with barrel loads,
mm-hmm.
you know, wheelbarrow loads of good data that will help him with his small project.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the point we left with, and he got, that these guys are for real.
Right.
They are players, and I have to take them serious now. Mm-hmm. I got to talk to them. I can't just assume all the genetics is going to be done in my institute or NCI. These guys know what the issues are, and they are going to put the money up, and they're going to be out front.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a message we wanted to leave.
As a tiny bit of a side issue, is it harder to convince people whose focus on genetics is on genetics that there's also a role of the environment, or harder to convince people whose focus is on the environment that there's also a contribution made by genetics?
I must say, I'm not sure which is most. They're both stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to guess, I would say it's been easier. The environmental people just won't. Maybe because of their training, it's easier to learn about the environment,
mm-hmm.
and certainly the technologies and techniques and thinking can. Francis Collins, for example, is very into environment now,
mm-hmm.
and all he needs to figure out these few little things, and we're working with him mm-hmm. and collaborating to make sure they get that. But our people, toxicologists or an environmental health scientist, are reluctant to think about genetics
mm-hmm.
because it's going to mean that they have to go out and learn new ways of doing things, mm-hmm. I mean, totally new. And so I might actually believe that it's the my community
mm-hmm.
that's most difficult to get them to buy into that genetics is.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think our community thinks that, as I said earlier, you identify the risk factor
mm-hmm.
and you know that asbestos. And so no matter how important that is to our economy, just remove it.
Mm-hmm.
And asbestos maybe is fine. You can do that.
Right.
But there are some other things that would be more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say it is here.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things are here already,
mm-hmm.
and we aren't going to be able to get them out of our environment for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, I can say this, Francis Collins now uses the word gene-environment interaction as much as I do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that says something.
Right.
And I went to the 5-year strategic planning session for his institute.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me because the focus is on gene environment interaction. Now, I know privately he thinks the environment genetics is going to be a bigger player. I don't think he's been fully convinced that the environment's as big a player as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows that he can't go forward unless he understands the interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, I think the environment's going to be the major player.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, you need both. But it's the interaction that's key.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you say the contribution of the environment versus the contribution of genetics to any given disease, the environment's going to be the major 2/3, 75% of the cause. You got to have that environmental trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, nothing's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's convinced of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people like Terhoni is being convinced of it. And their gene environment now, when by the time Harold Varmus left, he was talking about gene environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to get the rhetoric, it's something else to feel it. And I'm not sure they have that yet internalized, but they do, they'll get there. I think we're going in the right direction. And as I'm stepping down, I just said to my deputy director, who's also a finalist for my job, when we walked out of the office, you know, I said, this is going to be an exciting time in the years ahead for environmental health scientists.
Mm-hmm.
You got to work hard at it. You got to make sure you stay at the dining table, and you got to, and stay in the thick of things. But it's exciting.
Yeah, and I hear that from the scientists I interview too.
Right.
And I hear them talking, those who are kind of in the later stages of their career, talking about how they're angling to stay in the lab a little longer than they would have otherwise because they want to be part of this.
It's going to be a very exciting time. And I think the environmental part is going to get more money
mm-hmm.
because I just said to Sam Wilson tomorrow morning, my deputy, I showed him that article.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have just yesterday, we're already collaborating with Francis Collins to develop the next wave, the next large longitudinal study, which is the adult one, and the title is Gene Environment Interaction, right? Family and gene and family study, gene and back to explore gene environment interaction. That's from coming from Francis. That's Ethan's title. So we will be in the Washington Post and your local newspaper for that too. And so I think it's a very exciting time. But the challenges are going to be just they're going to have very visionary leadership to do that. And whoever comes in, the battle isn't over. Because as I'll tell you, with NTP, I think we've got a lot of work to do. I think I've got things started, and I think I've changed the mindset. But there's a lot of work to be done, because I don't think the interactive coordination, I don't think NTP has yet taken full advantage of all of the innovations in genomics or whatever, omics, proteomics and all, that we can. Now, you can understand why that would be the case, because to get risk assessors to use technology or data generated by some unknown technology or a technology that's different and hasn't been in their minds validated, it's going to take a little while. So the policy application is going to be lagged behind the science. But I think we're pushing it, and we are. And I have two academy committee meetings, groups, set 500,000 each, to get them to bring the scientific community together, bring all the stakeholder industry, regulatory agencies in one room, and let's begin to talk about how we're going to use, let's say, genomics data in human risk assessment. And we need to do that now. Get the mindset, get people to think and talk about what science is needed before I would be convinced as an environmentalist or as an industry executive, before I would say, okay, you can use this. And unless we get those warring factions together to agree on something, 5 years down the road, we'll have all the data. And I'll say, my gosh, this is valid. And everybody says, no. We got to wait 10 years. So we're moving that now. So I think we're having those discussions, those battles, and when we're there, we listen. Matter of fact, they write me a report after every meeting, and I can see what people are saying about this test or that test, and we can do the studies to prove or disprove whatever and validate. And so I think that's very important. And so I'm dissatisfied, let's say, impatient, with the rate at which, say, you're going to ask me about transgenics, all these things are being incorporated. But I do see them, it is occurring. FDA and EPA, all of them are talking about, will they use genomic information? Yes, they're thinking about it. They're putting in place rules, regulation, guidelines for all of this stuff. So we're making progress. But we aren't there yet, and we need somebody to still push the envelope.
So would you say that omics is among the most important scientific development
Absolutely.
For the environmental health sciences?
Absolutely.
Are there other developments, or is that kind of the premier
example? I think that's part of it. I think the other thing that I've done, and I think I'm giving credit for, and that is to be emphasize behavioral aspect of human health. NIH itself, even though we have an institute that's supposed to do that, I guess, I think the NIH has not put enough emphasis on behavior. And reason for that, in part, is those of us who become directors of institutes or laboratory scientists or clinicians, and very few of us are psychiatrists or behavioral scientists. So, and also behavioral science, you don't have the objective measures of outcomes as you do in a laboratory or a clinic. And so basic scientists and clinicians object to soft science and this and that. But you know, in the end, even if you develop a vaccine, which certainly is not a behavioral thing, you have a vaccine, it may work. But it won't work if you don't get parents, mom and dads, to take their kids to be vaccinated. And if only 50% of the nation get vaccinated against something, an infectious agent, it won't work either. You have to have almost 100% compliance. So in the end, you need people to buy into whatever new invention or technology you develop. So I think you may as well get people bought in and vested up front into the science. And a lot of things we don't need, and we're taking on obesity and the environment, the built environment. And we're co-funding something with Robert Wood Johnson now, the guy studying the street. Well, you don't need a new pharmaceutical agent. You don't need to know anything about the person's genes. You know, and all you need to do is get a person to change their behavior. Right?
Which is more complicated.
Which is
than
more
it sounds,
complicated
right?
than it sounds. But you can do that.
Right.
And we've got to figure out that certainly we can do pretty well at changing middle class people's behavior. But it's the other groups that we can't change their behavior. Not the every middle class person is changing their behavior either. But we do better with educating people like you and I. And, you know, we probably neither one of us smoke, and certain things we gave up because we never took up because we were told by our parents or our teachers that this was, or we read the newspaper or magazine, that it was not healthy, so we didn't do it. So we just have to figure out, though, and that's research, how to reach the other population. What is it we must do? And for example, we are now, we've contracted with a fellow who used to work with Sesame Street and the electric company, I guess, and we're creating a show, a program, just like Sesame Street, called the Fitness Bikers, and because we think the way to reach kids, I have a 16-year-old daughter, and I have then three older kids, and the older kids, all of us, including me, myself, and my wife, my three older kids, we're from a different generation. All of us are thin, and the little one was thin as, and my wife and I just got that. She was thin as long as we controlled her. But now that she drives and goes to school, and she's in a different setting than we all, and now she tends to be chubby, so we have to work on her constantly. It's because it's a matter of lifestyle. It's not, she's genetic, it's a matter of lifestyle. So it can be done. So it's that age group that we're targeting at this movie. Sesame Street too. I mean, even younger, because we want to. Because it's gonna be fitness fighters, and it's gonna be. What's the word I'm trying to think? Anyway, cartoon characters. And so we think that we can make a difference because where kids are, unfortunately, we are using TBS means to reach them, but that's where they are anyway.
Yeah.
So that's where you got to go.
Right.
So I think that's the other thing. So for example, beginning to support community involvement in research, community-based participatory research, having confidence that people can make some decisions about what's important to their health, and they can participate in research, and you get them to get vested and buy in to the research. So when the results come out, I mean, you'll have people, community people, maybe who do many different things, going around talking to their friends, to get them to change their behavior, and they can do a much better, effective job of that than you and I can walking out in the engine. They don't know us. So, the translation will be very fast.
The uptake.
Uptake much faster. Right. And so that's the other thing. So I think that's also important. And I take, health disparities. I mean, that's what it's really about. A poor black person or a poor any person, any racial group. I mean, you and I don't have all this excess morbidity and mortality. Why should they? It ain't genetics. It has to be cultural. It's behavioral. So let's change the behavior of those people so they can have a good health. And health care will go down, and productivity will go up, and a lot of things will happen. That's good. So we already know how to prevent a lot of things that we're not preventing. Obesity, we know how to prevent it. Women, I gather, things like that. I heard that cigarette lung cancer becoming the major number one killer in women from cigarette smoking. Well, we know how to deal with that. We know the cause. Somehow we haven't stopped young girls from smoking and getting addicted when they're, in grade school, high school, I guess. So we have to do that. So I think that's very important. I keep pushing NIH to to do that.
Now, how do any of these innovations and directions then kind of integrate back with the mission of the NTP? How do you, is there a dialogue across?
Well, it's the environment. I defined, the environment was defined too narrowly when I got there. Just the definition was so narrow. It was chemical and physical, mostly chemical. I mean, they almost never thought of physical, but they would. They thought of radiation. But I said, you know, that's not, the environment's much more than that. The environment is your lifestyle choice, lifestyle. It is diet, nutrition, certainly it's pharmaceutical exposures. And it's things like poverty, and poverty is not a genetic thing, it's behavioral or whatever. And so we then expanded the definition, and I see it being used more and more and more and more, our definition, by everybody. And we did that because I wanted to be sure that when I went before Congress, or, you know, and they found out that I would put $10, $20 million in behavioral research, well, why are you doing that? That's not right, your mission. Well, as a matter of fact, I just got the question from the department about the built environment conference. Why are you, this is, you know, HUD or somebody else's. And I said, nope, the environment is the built environment is a behavioral. We deliberately modify the environment in this way, and so this is the environment. So I had to give them the definition of the environment, and then their objection went away. And Secretary Thompson then wrote me a letter saying he would come to make a presentation. But originally there was this query. This is not your mandate. Well, of course it was.
David Rosner, who's a historian at Columbia, has a grant from Robert Wood Johnson now for a book on, the tentative title is An Unnatural History of Public Health, Building the Worlds That Kill Us. Lend itself to these sorts of arguments as well.
And that's what we've done. If I was buying a house today, I would go to a neighborhood. Of course, I wouldn't have many places to go, but I would go to a neighborhood that was people friendly, where there were walking paths, and trees, and you know, things. So I could, and I live in a neighborhood like most other people. I live on a cul-de-sac, and you can't walk in the street. That's it. And there's no way to meet and get to a grocery store except risk my life out on the major thoroughfare. And so you don't tend not to walk as much. But I was just in Tennessee. I'm a Tennessean. And I was just in it, and they showed me a beautiful neighborhood. And, you know, they were, you know, the most expensive homes. But right down in the middle, you know, the roadway going one way and left, you know, but in this four lane was trees, grass, and a walking path. Right? Now, and it went for miles. And people were using it. And that's what we were doing with Robert Wood Johnson. Their hypothesis is if we create, they're partnering with cities and state and county government to create some model neighborhoods. Now, they didn't have money to do the evaluation. So we're then funding the evaluation part. So, and the question is, do you see more people out walking in such neighborhoods? You can count them. Do those people tend to be on average lower body mass? And so you can weigh them. And so there are lots of things you can do. You see little kids riding cycles, and my guess is, I tell you, walking through this, driving through this neighborhood, yes, everybody was out here. And so I think that you get results. The result that we want, people will be less obese, there will be less comorbidity. So I think that this is another area is redefining the environment so that it's legitimate for us to deal with these issues, and people see that it's beyond, it's more than just these synthetic chemicals. And that's all we focus on, synthetic. We didn't focus very much on the natural ones. But even the natural chemicals, you know, we weren't intent to eat all these things. And so some of those are just as toxic.
Let me ask you about the genetically modified mouse models, because I want to make sure we touch on that today. You were at the helm of the NTP when these models were developed there. Can you talk to me about your perspective on that program?
Yes, yes. I've talked to Congress on two occasions about them. And I think, I know, let's say we're developing them at the moment for carcinogenicity testing. Mm-hmm. The two-year rodent bioassay for carcinogenicity takes us 2 years, by definition, to do. And takes another 2 to 3 years to do the histopathology, to peer review, and to report it out. So it's 5 years. On average, a test costs anywhere from $2 to $6 million per chemical, depending on whether it's by gavage, by oral, or by inhalation. $2 to $6 million. It takes 800 animals, and so it costs too much. That's why I say it costs too much. It's too slow, and uses too many animals. And in the end, it's not very informative. Mm-hmm. So that's what you get for it, mm-hmm. $2 to $6 million.
Not very formative.
Not very informative. Because all it does is give you yes or no answers. It doesn't tell you anything about pathways, mechanism, so nothing you can do. And I'll just give you one example where when I got there and when I changed things and brought the two together, phenolphthalein, we determined in NTP during my time that phenolphthalein was carcinogenic. Mm-hmm. It's an active ingredient in some laxatives, mm-hmm. like X-lax, which was the most commonly used laxative. Mm-hmm. Well, phenolphthalein was the active ingredient. Mm-hmm. Well, we discovered that it was carcinogenic. And it was carcinogenic in both males and female mm-hmm. animals and in multiple organ systems. Mm-hmm. So that's carcinogenic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not maybe, it's carcinogenic. But we didn't know anything about mechanism. Mm-hmm. So we've sent the data information to the FDA. And they did what you would do well, they sent out an alert to physicians, just alerting them that we had found this result. But nothing else happened. Mm-hmm. So, but since the two programs had been brought together, the NTP people just walked across the hallway and mentioned this study to ask a couple of our geneticists, would they look at it? In other words, what did it do in terms of genes? Did it influence oncogene expression or alter suppressor gene functions? Well, we discovered that in a matter of months, not a year, less than a year, that phenolphthalein modified oncogene expression. It turned on or off. I don't remember, but I guess turned it on. Anyway, we then sent that information to FDA. So now we not only we know it causes cancer, but we have a possible mechanism. We did not prove, but possible. That information, FDA pulled phenolphthalein pulled out of all laxatives. So now there are no laxatives. Too many animals, not very informative. So if we're going to test the chemicals in the universe, this universe that we're exposed to, that we need to test, we don't need to test all of them, but there are more chemicals to be tested than we could ever test. Given the cost and the time. So, and chemicals are being made now so fast. Mm-hmm. So we can't even keep up at the rate that they're being made. Mm-hmm. So you have to have test systems then that are fast and cheap. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, I've got strongly behind it, put the money into it, and push to develop the transgenics. Well, the transgenics will identify a carcinogen in 6 months, not 2 years, at just a fraction of the cost. Mm-hmm. So maybe then you could, and so it's fast and cheap, mm-hmm. and it's predictive. Mm-hmm. Now, and actually now some, we use it, mm-hmm. and it's FDA will allow it, EPA will allow use a transgenic and one standard, a mouse or a rat. So right now you have to do a mouse and rat. Mm-hmm. Well, they say you can substitute a transgenic. So mm-hmm. we've already had a huge impact. Mm-hmm. But that's, you could say that we reduced the cost to industry and to the government mm-hmm. to one half mm-hmm. of what it would cost us to ballot to determine something carcinogenic. Mm-hmm. So if it's carcinogenic and it's one of the transgenics or two, both of them, or two or three of them, then and transgenic and the standard, then you've got it. You don't have to do the rat as well. So we already made an impact. But the idea was to develop a test system that are fast and cheap. Now, something else I hope I've changed, and that is, I don't think any one test system will ever be the be-all, end-all. In other words, I think what we're going to be using in the future is a battery of test systems that are fast and cheap. And so, if it costs me only $100,000 to do 3 test systems, and in combination, I can believe, and in combination that is just as predictive as a 2-year bioassay, then why spend $2 to $6 million and wait 5 years if I can do this in a matter of 3 months or 2 months? And I'm hopeful that we can do this in a matter of weeks with time. So that's the purpose in doing that. Now I've moved, so I think the transgenics are already, they're already being used. It's already had a huge impact. But I think, and the transgenics that I think we can make better ones. I think that's just the first generation of transgenics. So I think when we understand more about the mouse genome, which we're now beginning to do, the human genome, about the variations, which genes are responsible for cancer susceptibility, for example, I think we can make better transgenics. So I think proof of principle is the ones we have will work. And they're much cheaper, they're faster. And they're being used. So we've already made a huge impact. But I think the thing that's going to happen, though, is the toxicogenomics is where the big excitement is. So that's why I created the toxicogenomics center. I said, why use even a transgenic animal? Why wait 3 months, 6 months? Why can't we do this in 1 week? Toxicogenomics, I think, is going to allow us to do just that. I think you can look at gene and protein and metabolite expression patterns. Now, you can't do protein so well yet. You can't do metabolites so well yet, but you can already do gene expression. But we're going to be able to take gene, protein, metabolite expression profiles, and the NIH roadmap takes all those, are developing all that. We're going to be able to take those technologies and go into a laboratory and generate a fingerprint, a signature pattern that is absolutely predictive of toxicity. And that will happen within 5 to 10 years, I'd say. We'll be able to do that. I think 5 years we'll be using it, some of them. Because we've already done proof of principle studies that show that we can differentiate between a toxic versus non-toxic substance. We got a pharmaceutical, we mean in people in the institute, I didn't do it, Ray Tennant and his colleagues. They're partnering with industry group, I escapes me the name now, Ray Stoll, who is Boehringer Manor. Yep. And Ray and Ray Tennant, the industry, pharmaceutical company, sent us, I think, 23 chemicals, pharmaceuticals. And we didn't know what they were, just sent them to us. And so we were blinded. And we were supposed to test them and see if we could identify them by class and say whether they're toxic or non-toxic. Well, I think we got 21 of the 23 correct. Now that's, to me, pretty good.
Oh yeah.
That's pretty good. So it's gonna work. It's just a matter of putting it in place and fingerprint. It's like the FBI fingerprint database. If your fingerprint is in the database and you commit a crime and they get a fingerprint, they can pick you out of a population of almost 300 million people. Well, we're going to be able to do the same thing from a population of 70,000. We don't have 300 million chemicals. So it's doable, and we know it's doable. It's going to be as powerful as a DNA test and as unique. And if they get a sample of your DNA, they can do the same thing. So we're going to be able to do the same thing. It's going to be a signature pattern, kind of up and down waves. And right now, it's very complex and not doable. But informatics can sort all that out and say, and give you a very simple picture. And maybe the ones that are going to be predictive in just 4 to 5 little spikes. And you see those, that's toxic. If you don't see them, it's not. Or whatever. And so that's exactly what's going to happen. So that's the reason I'm pushing toxicogenomics and create a toxicogenomics center. Mm-hmm. Everybody doesn't like the toxicogenomics center, but it is the wave of the future, and I hope the new director doesn't de-emphasize that. Mm-hmm. It is going to go. It's going to go. It's going to be what happens. Whether this institute continues to lead it as we are now, I guess depends on, because it does take money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm willing to chance my legacy to put the money there.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't lead it, I don't think the NIH is the leader in science. We're not. And that's what the American people expect of us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could have let industry, whatever his name was, clone the human genome.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't. We put in the money, mm-hmm. and we kept scaling up the budget of Genome Institute to make sure that when we rolled out the human genome and the announcement was made, the director of the NIH and Francis Collins could be beside the president.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, Craig Venter's group. So we were there. Craig Venter was there, but we were there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the combination of the two different approaches,
right,
that got us the human genome, mm-hmm. project fast.
Mm-hmm.
So industry is going to do toxicogenome where we do it or not,
mm-hmm.
but I want us to do it. I want NIEHS, NIH to be up front on that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say, where did the leadership come from on that,
mm-hmm.
that came from NIEHS.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we started. So
I know that the pharmaceutical industry has been very active in that area. Has
right.
the chemical industry also been active?
No, not as much.
Okay.
Pharmaceutical company, they are active. They were already active from a different point of view, because toxicogenomics is just the flip side of pharmacogenomics.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to identify drugs that have for active sites.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the other side. So but in the end, they have to prove
mm-hmm.
that their pharmaceuticals are safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes them 5 years too,
mm-hmm.
right? And cost me, so it costs too much,
mm-hmm.
and it takes too long. The bottleneck in pharmaceutical development is clinical trials,
mm-hmm.
and toxicity testing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get, 17 years of patent protection. So if they could shorten, I've calculated that, so if they could shorten the toxicity tested by 3 years, whew, that's lots of bucks,
mm-hmm.
for a big drug.
Mm-hmm.
So they can sell that drug to us,
mm-hmm.
under patent protection for 3 extra years, mm-hmm. that they would not if they have to spend 5 years,
mm-hmm.
in toxicity testing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gonna help with clinical trials, because you're gonna be able to predict efficacy,
mm-hmm.
and you won't have drugs being put on the market and then recalled.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I'm interested in this is that many of the same folks from the pharmaceutical industry,
right.
who were collaborating with NIEHS to develop the transgenic mice,
yes, right.
are now collaborating
right.
around toxicogenomics.
Right. Right. Exactly.
What are the ways in which those initiatives are related? Did they build on each other, or is it more a matter of personal networks?
We didn't have collaboration with industry when I got there. That's the other thing. We weren't partnering with industry.
Mm-hmm.
Industry was a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, that's silly.
Mm-hmm.
Industry is in the same business we're in. I mean, they need these tests as much as we do.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we go out and partner with them? At least we can use their intellect and their experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out and identified, I think, about 30 industry people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, time. All right, thank you. And invited them to come to Research Triangle Park and meet with us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I pulled together that group around transgenics.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had them as natural partners.
Mm-hmm.
And we had more than one meeting. So they would come to RTP, we'd talk about partnering and how we were going to do this. And so when we started toxicogenomics, it was natural.
Mm-hmm.
So we continued those talks.
Okay.
And so we've had a lot of, but we have had those talks with chemical manufacturing industry, but it hasn't gone as far, I would say. And I've gone to their meetings and had them at ours, and we've had those kind of joint meetings,
mm-hmm.
but I think it hasn't, although we do some collaboration,
mm-hmm.
with both.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, uh, So I think the relationship, but partnerships are very important, and that's something, but I've called hell with some of the partnerships, mm-hmm. if you just tell you that. Every couple of years of one, we have a partnership with the chemical, well, called the American Chemical Council, which is the trade organization representing the American Chemical Council. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a partnership with them, and we co-fund grants. Mm-hmm. In other words, they pass money through to us, and we fund the grants by the typical NIH peer review process. But, and looking at the health effects of chemicals on development. Mm-hmm. And they're interested because, it's their product. They want to know, is it safe? And we convinced them to partner with us to do it, and they did. But every now and then, I hassle my institute about freedom of information requests about this or that. But it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Because industry is part of America, and they create jobs, and they do a lot of good things. Mm-hmm. And there is no reason why we can't maintain our independence and integrity at the same time, have some collaboration. We have to put in place safeguards to make sure that the interest of the public is protected. But that should happen. Mm-hmm. And so that is what we're doing. But it is not something that is new. And people, they didn't do it before, and why are we doing it now? And industry, you should never co-fund something with industry. If industry is willing to give up all the rights and privileges, in other words, we call the shots. Mm-hmm. We say, we're going to, look at the grants, we're going to fund them by our NIH standard, and people can publish, and there's no secrecy, and they don't have to call you and to give you 6 months head start. Mm-hmm. These are typical NIH grants, and you have access to the data same way we do. Mm-hmm. Then if you can deal with that, then we'll co-fund things. Mm-hmm. And so I am confident that the American public's investment is being protected. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, I've got to run. I'm not sure we can.